This is Ed Asner, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. On today's edition, host Craig LeBeau talks with Diane Rust Tierney, the director of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, about why she feels the death penalty makes us less safe, and strategies for ending executions in the U.S. Then, in the second half of the show, we replay an interview from July that host Beth Pike did with Shelley Metzge, whose experience after the murder of her son prompted her and her husband, Robert Norris, to found Corey's Network to help families of murder victims navigate the aftermath of tragedy. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the show and the 420 drug war news at the end of the show. Up next is Craig and his guest, Diane Rust Tierney.
This is Craig LeBeau, and you are listening to Jaws of Justice. My guest today is Diane Rust Tierney. She is the executive director of the National Coalition Against the Death Penalty. She has been there since 2004 in public policy and litigation advocacy. She has served as the director of the American Civil Liberties Union Capital Punishment Project before that. Welcome, Diane.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, can you just give us a little bit of history of what National Coalition Against the Death Penalty does?
Absolutely. Well, we actually are going into our 40th year of celebrating our 40th anniversary. We were founded right after the Supreme Court said that the death penalty was appropriate under our Constitution in 1976. And we've been working ever since then to help the public understand how death penalty is inconsistent with our values, how the death penalty actually harms the things that we think are important, like public safety and a commitment to equality and justice under the law. We're happy to say that the tide has turned finally.
What is the most recent polling figures as far as support or opposition to death penalty?
Over the last several years, we've seen the death penalty support drop consistently. The latest Gallup poll shows that just 61% of the public supports the death penalty, and that's a 40-year low. When I first started working on this issue, public support was up around 80 and 90%. There really was a much greater attachment to the death penalty than we have now. So the other significant thing that we're seeing is that public opposition has really increased. It's at 37%. 37% of the public believes that the death penalty is wrong and needs to end. And part of our mission is really empowering that large group of people in our country who understand how broken the death penalty system is and are really urging our country to move in the direction of change.
When you say the system is broken, tell us in what ways it's broken.
The first thing you have to look at is, does the death penalty do what it's supposed to do? Does it enhance public safety? We have ample evidence over the 40 years that we've been dealing with the death penalty that it just doesn't enhance public safety. If you look at the parts of the country that use the death penalty most frequently, the South, you see that the murder rates in the South are higher than parts of the country where the death penalty is used less frequently, like the Northeast. And this happens over and over again over many years. The other way it's broken is that we have had these terrible incidents of people who have been found guilty, sentenced to death, but wrong. 156 people have been released from death row who were found to be innocent. And that's just a terrible tragedy that none of us could ever want to even think about, the possibility of executing an innocent person. But that's what's happened. And then we also have the terrible problem of racial disparities. You know, the death penalty is used overwhelmingly when victims are white as opposed to when victims are African American. And if you're an African American defendant, you're more likely to get the death penalty than a white defendant. And so we have these problems, and the death penalty isn't giving us anything to show for it. So that's one of the ways in which it's been broken.
When we talk about innocence in the 156 that were exonerated, a lot of those were exonerated through DNA evidence. Is that correct?
That's correct. There are lots of different ways that people it comes to be seen that people are innocent. And sometimes it just boils down to to luck. But in a number of cases, it has been DNA evidence that absolutely, you know, shows that the person we thought was the person who committed the crime was not.
And oftentimes, I don't actually have DNA evidence available. When that's not available, that increases the risk of somebody innocent being executed. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And again, what we're also seeing is that there's a correlation between racial discrimination and the risk of executing an innocent person. So a majority of the people who have been released from death row because of innocence happen to be African-American, and there's that pattern as well. Just very disturbing. And then you have the other issue of cost. You know, at the end of the day, these cases from the very beginning are expensive. And you say, what do we have to show for it? And in a state like Kansas that doesn't has the death penalty but has not used it for 50 years, you say, why are we spending this kind of money? And I think that the good news is that there are many people coming together now looking at the criminal justice system and saying, okay, can we be smarter about this? Can we do a better job? Can we focus on the things that we all agree are going to keep us safer? Better education, an investment in the economy that produces jobs with living wages, better housing, mental health services, and treatment for trauma. Those are the things that we know will keep our community safer, will provide for healthier neighborhoods. And if we're not focusing our energy and resources on the death penalty, we'll have some time and resources to spare to work on those things that we know work.
When you talk about the 156 that were exonerated and freed, what have you done as far as talking to the victims' families? Have you had contact with them? And after the exoneration, did that have an impact on their support or opposition to the death penalty?
Yeah, well, first of all, let me say that I've been honored to be able to work side by side with so many family members of homicide victims. And the second thing I would say is, regardless of how you feel about the death penalty as a family member of a homicide victim, however you feel is however you feel. That we are not in a position to sort of say, and don't want to ever be in a position of saying, well, we, you know, dividing victims. How you feel is how you feel. But our focus should be on how do we heal, how do we support. And what we see in many places is that there's a lot of rhetoric and talk about the death penalty, but not enough action and resources going to victims. And so one of the things that we believe is true about addressing the death penalty is that we take the covers off of that thought and really allow people to see, oh, we're not doing enough for victims. Let's make sure we're focusing our resources and attention on that. But to go to your other point, one of the sad things, the travesties about if you don't have the right person, you really haven't provided those families with the things that they want, which is to have an opportunity to have the person who caused the harm brought to justice. And so the death penalty and the focus of resources and skipping over the fact that we have the risk of executing an innocent person oftentimes causes the victim's family more trauma and pain, because all this pressure that's been put on the system around this individual and then comes to light that that isn't the right person. So the death penalty is a very painful and traumatic institution for everybody it touches. It's victims, people who work in the prison, the lawyers on both sides, prosecutors and defense, jurors. It's a traumatizing and painful institution that doesn't give us anything. It doesn't give us anything for all the costs, financial and opportunity and value costs as well.
How many states still have the death penalty?
You know, the reality is that most of the country doesn't actually have the death penalty. The death penalty is on the book, but the reality is the death penalty is not a, if you will, a live institution in most of the country. There are 19 states that don't have the death penalty, including 7 that have ended the death penalty in one way or another since 2007. There are 4 states that have a gubernatorial moratorium in place, where governors have either said, you know, there's not going to be a death penalty on my watch, or in a place like Oklahoma, where they're struggling to figure out how they're going to go about carrying out these executions, where they can't get it together. And in fact, only 2% of the counties in the country produce all the death sentences in the country. So, you know, just to put it in perspective, in 2014, we had 35 executions. Those 35 executions only came out of a handful of states. 80% of the executions that took place in 2014 took place in just Florida, Missouri, and Texas. And then the number of death sentences last year was 73. And all of this is sort of at an all-time low. So the reality is that the penalty statutes may be on the books, but the death penalty is really only alive and well in a handful of states.
And what are the states that are actively executing people, let's say, in the last 5 years?
Those states are Texas. Missouri has been scheduling executions up to recently, just about every month. Florida. Georgia started the year off in 2015 with some very disturbing and shocking executions, an execution of a decorated Vietnam veteran who was clearly suffering from post-traumatic stress, and the execution of another individual who had severe mental disabilities. But it's really a handful of states that have been engaged in this. And I think it's important for your listeners to understand that, you know, the country has really moved away from the death penalty. Justice Breyer and Justice Ginsburg, in a dissenting opinion in a recent Supreme Court case called Glossop versus Grove, sort of documented all the evidence that demonstrates that, you know, as a society, we've basically moved away from the death penalty. And actually, Justice Breyer and Justice Ginsburg are of the view that, you know, that if we were to look at this question right now at the Supreme Court, that the court would probably should find that the death penalty is unconstitutional. So the reality is, as Justice Breyer said, most of the country doesn't live with the death penalty.
What is one of the obstacles of getting rid of the death penalty? I'm thinking of, like, political ramifications, and yet I know that on both sides of the aisle, Republican and governor, Democrat, there's been governors from both parties who have supported getting rid of it, but there's also been governors from both parties who supported keeping it. So if it's a political thing, it's not a partisan line issue. So why do so many of these governors and legislatures, some of them, think that they're going to be harmed politically when that clearly doesn't seem to be the case in the states where they did abolish it?
I would say that the biggest obstacles to the policymakers sort of moving as they should against the death penalty is inertia and lack of information. And you touched on the latter, and I'll start with that, which is that there is some misinformation out there that suggests that there's a political downside to being somebody who's against the death penalty, when polling over many years, and as you point out, the experience indicates it's the contrary. We have polled in many places over a number of years, and we see that the public will not vote against a policymaker who expresses concern, reservations, and ultimately comes to believe that the death penalty doesn't serve the public and public policy. And it makes sense, because what the public is looking for is leadership. They're looking for people who are willing to look at hard issues, to look at the facts, and make the best judgment that's in the best interest of the public. And what we've seen is, in every state where there's been that kind of careful consideration of the facts and weighing of competing values, that policymakers have come to the conclusion that ending the death penalty is in the best interest of the public. And that's why we've seen 7 states move away from the death penalty since 2007. If you study this issue, you understand that it's broken, that, you know, even people who support the death penalty concede that it's broken. They just think we should keep throwing bad money after good to try and fix something that we have not been able to fix in 40 years. So that's part of it. The other piece is inertia. We have a lot of issues to tackle, and particularly in places where we're not living in the world of Texas and Missouri, where we're dealing with monthly execution and being exposed to that kind of, I say, popular trauma over and over again, feels as though, you know, we don't have to deal with it. But the reality is, it's a quiet drain on our resources, and it lulls us into a false sense of security that we're doing the things that we need to do to keep us safe when we're not. And so that's one of the reasons that we have been so involved in trying to mobilize, energize, and empower the segment of the public that believes and understands that the death penalty is wrong. And we have an incredible opportunity now, as, you know, people across the country are looking at our criminal justice system and asking some hard questions. Does it make sense? Is it fair? Is it effective? And the death penalty is a crucial part of that. It's hard to think about reforming our criminal justice system when you have this albatross around its neck. And so we've been reaching out to national organizations and individuals. We have launched a campaign that we call the 90 Million Strong Campaign, which stands for the 90 million people who know that the death penalty is wrong and it's time to end. That's that 37%. And so what we're trying to do is to combat the lack of information and inertia by getting more and more people active to share the information about how broken the system did, and to connect with their policymakers and let them know it's a priority to try and do away with the death penalty so we can get on to having a more effective and fair criminal justice system.
I want to ask you a few questions about some facts that are cited on your website. Part of that relates to some studies that were done concerning the racial disparities, and the study in 2001 and another study about Capital Jury Project. Can you tell us about those studies and what they found?
Sure. One of the things that I think is most corrosive about the death penalty, and the Supreme Court said this in its opinion in McCluskey versus Kemp. McCluskey versus Kemp was a case coming out of Georgia in 1987, which challenged a remarkable pattern of racial bias. Looking at many years of death penalty sentencing and using some of the most sophisticated techniques for multiple regression analysis and really trying to analyze what factors are influencing outcomes. And the study was done by the late Professor David Baldus, who is an absolute genius in this area. What they found was controlling for all the kinds of factors that you would expect to explain why a particular case ended up as a death case and another case ended up where the punishment was something other than death, a life sentence. We found that people who kill white victims were four times more likely to get the death penalty than other victims. And this was after controlling for all those factors we talked about, you know, whether it was a prior criminal record, whether a gun was used, whether there was particular cruelty to the victim. When you control for all kind of factors that if you're sorting out the worst of the worst crimes, you would expect to have an impact, the only factor that kept coming up was race. Well, the Supreme Court was asked whether this was a constitutional violation, and they concluded that it was not. But one of the things that the court said was shocking and corrosive, frankly, is this notion that some disparity is inevitable and tolerable. And so the system that we have now tolerates a certain level of racial bias. And that racial bias that is tolerated goes beyond death cases. That decision in McCluskey was also used to fail to provide relief for racial disparities in sentencing elsewhere. And I think that this notion that we can tolerate a certain level of bias when it comes to death, when it comes to sentencing generally, is not consistent with our values. But it was necessary, the court thought, to continue the death penalty institution. So there, as we point out on our website, these studies, you know, in state after state where we have the death penalty, you can see those kinds of racial disparities. And it's not a surprise because we're coming from a history that once by law made distinctions about the punishment based on who the victim was and the defendant, who the defendant was. And again, without addressing those things, it's no surprise that those same attitudes influence the outcomes in capital cases. You know, the country's in the midst of a huge conversation about race and whether, you know, I as a citizen can expect to be treated the same way in my neighborhood or on the street as another citizen by the police and the criminal justice system overall. So these things are real. And what we've been doing is tolerating that kind of disparity with the most severe punishment. And so that's one of the points. The other point about jury exclusion is also true. I was just at the Supreme Court last week hearing an argument in a case out of Georgia where Georgia was defending a death sentence that had been produced by a jury from which all the African Americans had been excluded. And this case was unusual because it is not often that you actually find, as Steve Bright, who argued for the court at the Southern Center for Human Rights, said, that has a whole arsenal of smoking guns. And what were those smoking guns? The smoking guns were lists of jurors where the juror, were, their race was actually noted, a B by black jurors. Another list of jurors that were jurors that would be excluded, where, you know, the majority of those on the list were the black jurors. A smoking gun of excuses that didn't add up, a litany of excuses, almost 40 excuses that didn't square with the facts. And so there has been a longstanding practice of excluding African Americans from jurors so that African American defendants aren't facing a jury of their peers. There's an additional problem that goes beyond, that has some racial implications, but goes beyond that when it comes to the question of death-qualified juries. And that is, because there's the death penalty, prosecutors routinely strike people who have expressed concerns about the death penalty, even though they can still follow the law. So you end up excluding from the jury anybody who has any doubt in their minds about the death penalty, and you end up, studies show, basically stacking the death against defendants in favor of death. So, and we've seen that a number of different ways. It does have the impact of excluding women and people of color and religious people, because African Americans tend to oppose the death penalty, and with good reason. Women tend to have more concerns and skepticism about the death penalty. Religious people tend to have more concerns and skepticism about the death penalty. So there's a lot of evidence that continuation of the death penalty depends on us kind of putting our other values on the back burner.
Besides the racial disparities, to what extent have your studies indicated that the economic disparities also play a part, so that in terms of the quality of defense they get, et cetera?
Well, ample evidence over the 40 years that indicate if you have a good lawyer, 9 times out of 10, you will not get the death penalty. And a good lawyer and good representation costs money. In many places that have the death penalty, they want their cake and eat it too. I mean, many of the states that have the death penalty will refuse to provide the resources that are necessary to allow indigent defendants to have adequate resources to defend their case. And most of the people who are facing the death penalty are poor people and depend on the state to provide those resources. You have a constitutional right to an attorney at trial, but these cases are complicated. And you have to have an experienced attorney, and you have to have an attorney who has the resources to do investigations in these cases to get to the bottom of these facts. And if we started out talking about innocent people, one of the reasons that you find that they're innocent people on death row is because, in many instances, they've relied on lawyers who were not competent, lawyers who were not resourced so they could investigate. And so important evidence that would exonerate a person is missed, or important procedural deadlines that could save somebody's life are missed. And so it is true that it is very much skewed by income, and it's also geographically disparate. I mean, that's one of the things that people just don't understand how unfair it is. Like, in a particular state, again, oftentimes that connect to income, the same crime in one county will not carry the same punishment. So there are lots of disparities, but economic disparity, as you point out, is one.
As a criminal defense attorney myself, although I haven't done any death penalty cases, I can tell you in Kansas that I think most of the court-appointed attorneys is in counties that use that, as well as the counties that have public defender, most of the attorneys I've worked with are great attorneys. They do a great job with the limited resources they have, but they are limited by that. And when you compare what resources we have with what resources the prosecutors have, the prosecutors can go out, they're free to spend $50,000 on an expert, and we may be limited to $5,000. Well, of course, you're not going to get the same quality service, the same number of experts to testify for you if you have that kind of disparity in resources.
Exactly.
As far as where we go from here in terms of educating the public about death penalty, what do you foresee as being the best course of action for that?
Well, I think that, I think I started out the conversation, we're at an incredible point in our country. The death penalty is, by every measure, on its way out. Death sentences are down, executions are down, most states are not using the death penalty. And I think what needs to happen is for people to get involved, people who understand this issue to get themselves armed with the information, and there's ample information. I'm here with the Kansas Coalition Against the Death Penalty, and they have excellent material, and to talk to your friends and family. We have to let people know that there's a broken system, and we have to be visible, and we have to be active. And so there's a tremendous opportunity and tremendous resources right here in Kansas for people to really get engaged and offer to have a group come and speak at your church, or have some folks over to your home and maybe read a book like that Brian Stevenson has come out about, Just Mercy, and talk about what that means. I mean, this is an opportunity for everybody to get engaged and do their part. And every little piece that we do really changes people's thinking, because the reality is public support for the death penalty is based on a lack of information. And those of us with the information have an obligation to share it. And I think if we share that information, if we're in touch with our policymakers and letting them know what we're learning, that we will move this. And Kansas ending the death penalty is really important. There's been an effort that's been ongoing, and I'm very optimistic that we will see the end of the death penalty in Kansas. And that's an important message as well for the rest of the country. We have to encourage more people to look at this issue calmly, thoughtfully, pragmatically, and make the decision to do what's best for the community. So I would say arm yourself with the information. The Kansas Coalition Against the Death Penalty is a great source of that information. And then get active. You can educate your family and your network and your church or your parish, and it can snowball. And I think what it will do, it creates more space and opportunity for us to have the real conversation. How do we really keep our neighborhoods and families safe? Where do we really need to be making investments? The key, what kind of people do we really want to be, and what relationship do we want to have with our government? I like the way that the coalition has definitely talked about justice without a doubt. As long as we have the death penalty, we're always going to have that doubt. And we can have a system of justice that doesn't have that nagging doubt. You know, I've been here visiting with people. One of the things that I think is really important for policymakers to hear.
Thank you for joining us. We've been talking with Diane Rust Turney, who is the National Director of the National Coalition Against the Death Penalty. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was my pleasure.
Now, the calendar for December 7th, 2015. All are welcome to the Moore Squared Monthly Issues Night. Monday, December 7th, 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at Trinity United Methodist Church, 620 East Armour Boulevard, KCMO. Parking is available in the lot due east of the church. Use the accessible east entrance to the basement lower level. Moore Squared's workforce/infrastructure, education, criminal justice, and access to health teams will be meeting. The Criminal Justice Task Force will meet Monday, December 7th from 6:45 to 8:45 p.m. at the Church of the Good Shepherd, 4947 Choteau Drive, KCMO. The Criminal Justice Task Force mission is to lobby the Missouri State Legislature for sentencing laws that are fair and humane. They will be collecting non-perishable food items for the after-school backpack program. This is their holiday gathering. You are invited to bring a friend and some snacks to share. For information, contact Robin Johnson at 816-522-4081 or email redrob, that's REDROB 2655 at yahoo.com. Mothers of Incarcerated Sons and Daughters will have their monthly meeting Saturday, December 12th from noon to 2 p.m. at the Waldo Branch Library, 201 East 75th Street, KCMO. If you have a loved one that is incarcerated and need advice and support, MISD has members that may be able to help. You are invited to come enjoy good company and holiday libations. Right before the third anniversary of the Sandy Hook shooting, supporters will gather all across the country to participate in Orange Walks to honor all of the lives lost to gun violence in America and show just how determined we are to end it. You can join the Kansas City Wear Orange Walk Sunday, December 13th, 4:30 p.m. at Country Club Christian Church, 6101 Ward Parkway, KCMO. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website. That's kkfi.org. You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Next week on Jaws of Justice, well, we have a number of possibilities in the works, and you will just have to listen in to find out if we are discussing how to stop gun violence, or helping women coming out of prison transition back to society, or something else entirely. Up next is a replay of the interview Beth Pike did with Shelley Matji of Corey's Network Incorporated.
And good morning, I'm Beth Pike. Joining me in the studio this morning is Shelley Matji. And Shelley is with Corey's Network, which is helping survivors. So welcome to the show, Shelley.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, I appreciate you being here. Your son, Corey Lakovich, age 22, was brutally attacked and he died from those injuries. And to my understanding, to this date, the case remains unsolved. Why don't you tell us about Corey? Give us some background on Corey.
Corey was 22. He was going to Wright Career College at the time. He wanted to be a PC tech. He was going through kind of a transition at that time. He and his wife were having some trouble, so at the time he was living with us and just trying to get through his degree and figure out what he wanted to do with the rest of his life. He was your typical 22-year-old.
I was going to say, at that age, you're still trying to figure it out.
Yeah, he was partying that night, not any drugs or anything like that. Alcohol, you know, the test showed that's all he had in his system. Earlier in the day, he'd come home and he was upset because he had to do direct deposit, which meant he didn't get to have any cash in his hand that day. So he kind of said a few things about how frustrated he was and et cetera. And he talked to me and my husband, Bob, and we said, dude, it's not that big of a deal. Every adult has to go through direct deposit. And he said, well, I'm going to go up to my room and eat my Taco Bell and I'll talk to you later. And we said, I love you. And I remember showing him a video that I had found, Lynyrd Skynyrd's Simple Man. And I'd sent that out to all three of my boys that week on Facebook and noticed that he hadn't said anything about it. And he watched it and he says, that's a really cool song, Mom. You know, thank you for sharing that with me. And then he went up to his room. When I got back from dinner, his car was gone, and a little while later, I got a pocket phone call from him, and I kept saying hello. Nothing happened, so I sent him a text. I said, but dial much, you know, nothing big. So later on in the evening, Bob and I were planning for a weekend away. Everything was normal. And then 2 o'clock in the morning, his younger brother came running down to our bedroom, and he knocked on my door because we sleep in the basement. We converted our den into a bedroom, and he opened up his door, or our door, that is, and he said, Mom, there's something wrong with Corey. He's got some kind of a cut or something on his neck, and he won't talk to me, and I think that it might be life-threatening because he just won't talk. And I ran up the stairs, and at the meantime, Justin dialed 911. And Corey walked out of the bathroom because he was sleeping in what's my office. He had a mattress in there. And he stumbled out. He wasn't speaking. He looked like he was trying to scream.
So he was trying to communicate, but he couldn't get anything out to you.
He couldn't get anything out. He was trying to scream. He was pale. His lips were blue. And I said, Corey, come here. So he started turning toward me, and he fell into my arms, and he quit breathing. And that was the first time he died. And I said, you can't do this to me. You need to breathe.
Breathe.
I actually yelled it.
Yes.
And when he breathed, he leaned back, and I saw another wound on him. And I said, tell them he's got another cut. And his brother started describing the other cut.
Because you still had 911 on the phone.
Yeah.
Right.
And they got there pretty quick. And then they took him out of the house. And my understanding is he died three more times before he finally died 36 hours later of a stroke.
Oh, yes. That's quite an ordeal,
it is,
Shelley, for you to have gone through.
It is.
And after that, then, of course, you began having to deal, you know, with the investigation. And what is it, you know, that you found that you faced when you were dealing with the investigators on this case with Corey? Because it's, you know, right now it's still gone as an unsolved.
It is. It's still unsolved. From the moment that he was picked up by the paramedics, it was immediately going into investigation. I couldn't go to the hospital with Corey. I had to stop and immediately start answering questions. I sat at my kitchen table as my son died three more times. And
so they didn't let you go to the hospital with him to follow through with that.
No.
They immediately began the investigation.
And, you know, to be honest, my father was a police officer for 30 years and a consultant for, I want to say, 10 more years with the police department in Chandler, Arizona. And, you know, I knew enough about police work that I knew that when there's any murder and you don't have, like, the suspect on the scene, that your family is immediately going to be the first suspects.
Yes.
Especially if you're the ones that found him. And they immediately started talking to me, questioning me, where were you, what were you doing? And my answers were always the same. I was in bed with my husband. That's the only answer I have. I don't have another answer. And what happened when your son brought you upstairs, and what was he doing? And, you know, I was asleep. What am I supposed to say?
You were telling them the truth. This is where I was.
This is where I was. This is where I was going. This is how I handled it. All I know is that my son quit breathing when I came in the room. And after they drilled me for probably a good 45 minutes or so, I got to the hospital, and they're investigating and et cetera. And, you know, I'm there with Bob and Justin and just kind of waiting for my son. And occasionally they'd come in and talk and et cetera. And they're about the investigation, and I understand that they're doing their job, but, you know, it's very hard to be both in grief and being the person that they're constantly asking, because
grief and interrogated.
Yeah, interrogated at the same exact time.
Right.
And once Corey died, we realized that Corey's clothing had been thrown away. No one had actually secured Corey's clothing, which is the responsibility of the police. And the police came in and said, well, where's Corey's clothing? And I said, you're the one who's supposed to secure Corey's clothing. Why are you asking me? And I had told them when I was talking to them that the last time I saw Corey's shirt, because apparently Corey took it off before I'd gotten upstairs, I said it was on the floor. So they made me get into a car right after I just got done hearing my son was dead, and brought me to my home and asked me where the shirt was. And I pointed to the place on the floor where it was. And that wasn't enough. And, of course, I had to go back to the ER, back to the ICU. I said, do you have his clothes? Because if you have his clothes, maybe you might have some of his jewelry, which is sentimental to me, and the clothing the police need. And they said, no, we don't have it. Check with the ICU. So I checked with the ICU. They said, we don't have it. Check with security. So they called down security. Security came down. We don't have it. The police should have it. So after all of this, I went back up to the ICU and I said, can you please find my son's clothing? And two nurses went downstairs and went through the biohazard and found my kid's clothing.
Found it in the biohazards.
Found it in the biohazard.
That should have really been collected as evidence from
it
the police.
Have been. The police, yeah, they dropped the ball. They did. And they did collect it. They took it. But apparently they did not look at it to see that it was sealed in its own bag until January of this year. So it was 20 months.
20 months before that they actually took a look at the evidence of the clothing.
Yes, and the clothing was not contaminated.
And it was not.
So, you know, you're up against a lot of different things when you go into the investigation. And it's been very hard for us.
Oh, absolutely.
It's been very difficult.
So, you know, besides that, you know, the problem with the evidence, was there any other gaps maybe in the investigation or the process that you found that maybe you disclosed?
There have been a few, but I'm not going to disclose those on air right now. But that one in particular is probably the hardest one for us to deal with.
Okay. That they'd had that and then, you know, it was just basically misclassified and not taken seriously as it should have been.
Which could actually solve the crime.
Right.
Right.
Right. There could be some DNA involved that would help to lead to who was the attacker.
Exactly.
Now, I know all of this, you know, prompted you to form what we're here to talk about today, which is Corey's Network.
Right.
And what exactly is Corey's Network? What do you do?
Well, let me back it up just a little bit for you.
Okay.
When going through all of this, the first thing that hit me, I've been in social work now for 27 years. I've helped families. I've been an advocate. I've talk people through some of the worst times in their life. I've done a lot of different things. So my assumption when they told me that Corey had died was that I would be given a victim's advocate by the police department. And so when I was standing there, you know, I'd already made the decision to donate Corey's organs. I'd already gone through the rigmarole of finding Corey's clothing. I'd already had all these other things going on, my assumption would be that I could go out and I could say, okay, where is my victim's advocate? And at that time, I was told, you will not be getting one.
Are you serious?
Serious. And I said, well, why not? And they said, Independence Police Department does not have a victim's advocate.
And so this is going to prompt you then to, you know, we're going to start something now.
That's exactly what prompted us.
The fact that you had to, that's no problem, that you had to face this and there was no advocate to help you through the process of the investigation while you were still in a state of grief.
There was no one to help us through the investigation. There's no one to help us navigate the media. No one to help us understand the investigation, to find counselors, to put together my funeral for my son, to help us find out about crime victims' compensation, to help us fund the funeral because we had no insurance. There was no one there that could help us with any of the process. And we were told that once someone was charged with the crime, that the county advocate could then help us. But until that time, we would not be receiving one, which means that in 24 months, next week will be Corey's anniversary of death.
Yes.
We have not received a victim's advocate.
Because there has been no charges against someone because it's an unsolved homicide.
Exactly.
So what you've chosen to do then by creating Corey's Network is provide that type of advocacy for others who might be facing the same type of situation.
Exactly. And so what our mission statement is that we provide immediate support and advocacy to the surviving victims of homicide that would include providing them with information about counseling and other social services that would be necessary to help them. We help them with understanding the investigative process. We help them with navigating the media. And then on top of that, we help them fund the funeral through both helping them through the process of crime victims' compensation and by helping them fundraise for any portion of that crime victims' compensation does not cover.
And how do the investigators feel about you when they're dealing with you as an advocate? How are you received?
We usually don't deal with the investigators in this.
Okay.
Because we're working with the surviving victim. And that's because most of the cases that we've had at this point have been through other jurisdictions, first of all. So we don't have to deal with the ones that have been in our area. Secondly, when we talk with them, we help them understand who to talk to, their rights with the media, and let them understand you do not have to let everybody stand on your front porch and push a camera in front of your face. You are in charge. You can take charge of this whole situation. Usually, like with the media, I'll be sitting 5 feet away from them so that they know, you know, who's in charge. They can talk to them at their will. We tell them about the investigation ahead of time so that they're prepared. And then the counseling services, that's nowhere near the police. And then again, the fundraising portion is nowhere near the police either. So
right.
At this point, we have not had to deal with the police, though I have done a presentation to the Metro Chiefs. And we did that a couple of weeks ago, and they actually were very receptive to the program. So far, we've not had to deal with the investigators.
Okay. Well, it sounds like, you know, what you're providing is just, you know, a really fantastic service to the community and to these families that are facing a similar situation that you have had. For someone who is in need, then, of Corey's services, how would they get in touch with you?
There are several ways that people can get in touch with us. Like I said, I have done a presentation to the Metro Chiefs, so the police departments do have the information on how to contact us. Secondly, you can also get a hold of us through our website, which is coreysnetwork.org. You can also email us, which is coreysnetwork@gmail.com. And you can contact us at 816-834-9161.
And social media? Are you using social media for this, I imagine?
Yes. If you want to get a hold of us on Facebook also, it's Corey's Network Incorporated on Facebook.
Okay. There's the Corey's Network Facebook page. Isn't there another one, too, In Honor?
Yes. The In Honor of Corey Lakovich is actually more along the lines of keeping track of what Corey's case is looking like at this time. And I use it as a blog. And what a lot of people find more from that one is they find more comfort of seeing how their grief and my grief are the same. And they can kind of understand or find some empathy in what I write on that page.
And do you get responses on the page from other parents or family or friends, maybe that have had similar experiences?
Yes, very much so. I think I have a more of a readership on In Honor of Corey Lakovich than I do on the Corey's Network Incorporated one. So,
you know, homicide affects everyone in a community, even businesses. So Corey's Network has been striving to involve businesses in helping the surviving victims. How have these businesses partnered with you?
Actually, at our last silent auction, we had 96 different businesses that donated gift cards and services, and we had baseballs from the Royals, we had footballs and basketballs from KUMU, K-State, a poster from the Chiefs, etc. We even had Chuck E. Cheese that's out there by Independence Center. And Chuck E. actually showed up at our fundraiser. And at first I kind of balked at the idea of having Chuck E. Cheese come out there. But there's a real sweet reason that Chuck E. came out. The first day I went out there, what I do, Beth, is I go out and I talk to the individuals, the general manager mostly, and I'll sit down and I'll show a picture of Corey and I'll say, "Do you remember when this happened?" And they'll say, "Yes, I do," or "No, I don't." And I'll tell them the story of what happened with Corey. And when I do this, they will say, "How can I help?" And I'll say, "All we're asking for is something that you can donate for our silent auction or our raffle." Well, I went out to Chuck E. Cheese, and the first person I spoke to, he said, "We don't do anything like that, but I'll keep this, you know, the information." And I thought, wow, that was really kind of rude. And I turn around, I'm like, you told a murder victim's mom no. And I said, fine, bye. And I walked out. The next day, another woman called me and she said, we're going to be able to donate to your cause. I've got a bag out here, but I'd really like to talk to you. And I came in and she said, look, you know, there are children that get murdered around here and we want to help. And we want to do more than just donate this baggie. What we want to do is if we have the ability to have a child that has been murdered or whatever, if there's a way for us to do a fundraiser for one night, and what we'll do is we'll print off all of the flyers and we'll do all of the advertising and we'll give you 15% of everything that comes in that night. And she said, we're on a bus line and we've got a lot of people that will come out here. We'll give you 15%. And I thought, 15% of all those change machines and everything? Mm-hmm. She said, yes. And I thought, you know what? If they're willing to do that, Chucky can come out here and eat from our cheese plate as much as he wants. So he came out and he supported us. But there are merchants out there that want to help, but nobody has asked.
So we can get that information out. We've got, I'm sure, several businesses that are listening. If you want to help out, please be sure to contact Corey's network. Why don't you go ahead, give us the contact information again so they'll have that.
Okay.
What's the best way to contact you?
Quickest way is always going to be 816-834-9161 or Corey's Network@gmail.com, or you can also go to our website, Corey's Network.org, and then also Facebook, Corey's Network Incorporated.
I thank you so much, Shelley, for joining me this morning. The community appreciates the services that you're providing. This has been Beth Pike, and thank you, Shelley. Thank you so much for being here in the studio with me on Jaws of Justice on 90.1 FM, KKFI.
It's the 420 Drug War News. The following was recorded at the International Drug Policy Reform Conference in Washington, D.C.
Introduce yourself, your organization.
My name's Randy Madden. I'm with 22 Too Many. I'm a founding member of the organization that is committed to preventing and raising awareness about the veteran suicide. On average, we have 22 veterans a day committing suicide in our country, and these are our brothers and sisters in arms that have sacrificed their lives to save the rest of us that are back here in the country living on a day-to-day basis and enjoying ourselves. In our organization, we use medical marijuana as a form of treatment to help us with our symptoms from our service in combat arms, to help us feel better and continue to live on a day-to-day basis and pass on our strength to others. And if we didn't have this medicine, the pharmaceuticals that we could be having in our systems that are pushed onto us by the VA could be keeping us comatose and locked up in our own homes. The negative side effects to them have been brought to my attention to where some of our males are even growing tits. I'm afraid to have any more medication from pharmaceuticals pushed into me. I have pain in my thumb from blowing my thumb out during mortar training, and I have 70% disability for my PTSD, and if I get any more of those pharmaceuticals in me, I'm afraid that I may end up either killing myself with a gun to my head because of the negative side effects and how that those medicines affect me mentally, and it doesn't do anything at all for my pain.
Those who served in Iraq and Afghanistan deserve more respect than they're given. They deserve the respect of our Congress and our populace, do they not?
I agree. Strongly agree. We should be fat and healthy and happy as we possibly can be for when any time comes that we're called back into service, we're ready and willing to do our part.
Right. Well, is there a website you'd like to share some closing thoughts, Randy?
22toomany.org is our website. It has information on there to help you get in contact with us and shares our mission statement and our purpose to allow you to know that we're here to raise awareness and we're here for you. You don't exactly have to go right to the VA for help. There's other organizations out there that are more than willing to lend you a hand at a moment's notice whenever you're in need.
Again, that was Randy Madden of 22 Too Many. Very brave soldier and a very brave advocate. Check out all this stuff from the conference. Going to be coming at you for weeks. Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Beth Pike, for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Liam, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical.